Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Liver Cancer Treatment Update. It's a very important program, and we are delighted to have so many of you on the call today. So we have over 101 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Malawi, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call as well. And today's program is made possible through an independent grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this remarkable program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Kelsey Laumann. And Dr. Laumann is a medical oncologist, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, assistant professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Laumann will be addressing a number of areas. She'll be discussing an overview of the treatment of liver cancer, including current standard of care, new treatment approaches, clinical trial updates, how research increases your treatment options, the role of radioembolization, controlling symptoms, treatment side effects, discomfort and pain, and guidelines to prepare for telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, follow-up appointments, quality of life concerns, and discussion of open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Laumann.
Well, Dr. Messner, thank you so much for that lovely introduction, and thank you for having me on today's call. It's a real honor to be here, and a real pleasure to be able to share a bit about liver cancer as a whole. Just to get started, you know, when we talk about liver cancer, what is it exactly that we're referring to? And there's actually multiple types of liver cancer, but the most common one, and I think the one that's the focus of today, is really called hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC. And HCC is one of, what I might argue, one of the most important tumor types to know about today, because it's a particularly common cancer type that we're seeing globally, but it's also becoming an increasingly prevalent cancer, and it's actually anticipated to continue increasing in incidence and in mortality over time. And so I'm really grateful to be here with you today to talk about what it is that makes liver cancer unique, what are some of the different treatment approaches that we use in the clinic, and what are some future directions, as well as how you can maximize your approach to care. And so when I meet my patients with liver cancer, I actually walk them through how it is that a patient may come to develop liver cancer to begin with, because I really do think this is one of the most unique aspects of this tumor. I tell people that about 80 to 90% of the time when they walk through an oncology clinic with a diagnosis of liver cancer, they're often coming to us with some other type of chronic liver disease as well. In its most severe form, that liver disease can be liver cirrhosis or scarring, but we can also see other types of liver disease, and much of this stems from risk factors, including viral hepatitis, the viral hepatitis B, which is endemic in many countries in Asia and Africa, and which we see in many of our immigrant communities here in the United States. We see viral hepatitis C, which can be transmitted through bloodborne means, including more recently through injection drug use. We're also seeing heavy alcohol use as a risk factor, and increasingly the role of metabolic disease, so essentially fat deposition in the liver that may accompany other conditions like diabetes, high cholesterol, or obesity. And so as you can imagine, it becomes quite a challenge to really balance these two conditions between cancer as well as some other kind of chronic liver disease. And as a result, it's really important that as we think about different types of treatment approaches, that we're actually taking both conditions into account as we craft a treatment plan for a given patient. And so what do we think about in terms of treatment? As you can imagine, it very much is tailored to a given patient and their clinical presentation, what their liver function is like, and what stage of disease they may have. And interestingly, what's unique about liver cancer is that the staging criteria that's most commonly used, it comes out of Barcelona, Spain, but the criteria actually dictate that we consider these two competing comorbidities in the liver disease, specifically using kind of a patient's underlying liver function to really determine what the best treatment option might be. And so assuming that a patient does have kind of intact or preserved liver function, there are a whole host of different options that we can consider. For patients with early stage disease, we often will think about surgical options. So with a single tumor, especially in a patient who has otherwise good liver function, we do try to resect those tumors. But in patients who may have other liver risk factors, the ultimate cure may actually be something like liver transplantation. Because if we worry that a patient's underlying liver disease may actually predispose to more cancers developing in the future, we want to make sure that we're mindful of that possibility as we think about long-term options. Here in the United States, though, it can take a while to get to transplant, and so we often will use other types of what we call bridging modalities to get there. And these modalities in and of themselves can also be definitive for patients who may choose not to pursue transplant, who may have other conditions that may preclude transplant, or who for whom transplant just may not make sense. And what's nice is that many of these options are focused just in the liver. So they're what we call liver-directed treatments. And they can range from very small and minimally invasive procedures to other types of approaches that are non-invasive altogether. And so it's not uncommon that I will partner with my interventional radiology colleagues, for example, to consider minimally invasive procedures, which can include what we call ablation. And so that's using imaging guidance to introduce a needle into a tumor, to either use microwave heat to burn a lesion. We may use cold energy through cryoablation. But these techniques are very, very effective, especially for small tumors in the liver. But when we start thinking about larger tumors, so typically greater than about 3 centimeters, we may think about other approaches. One other interventional radiology approach is radioembolization, which I know I've been asked to chat about, so I'm going to discuss that in more detail in a bit. But to round out the local regional options, we also will consider things like chemoembolization as well as external beam radiation, all of which are really excellent treatment options, especially for patients with tumors that are confined to the liver. And so I'm going to take a little segue to talk about radioembolization, though, going out of order a little, which I hope is okay. But radioembolization is probably the newest kid on the block when we think about these local treatment options that are directed to the liver. It's a relatively newer technology, but many centers are getting quite a bit of experience, and I'm very fortunate to work at a center that's very comfortable with this technology. But what it is it's basically taking advantage of the different blood vessels that may feed to a cancer in the liver, and essentially using that highway of blood vessels to introduce treatment beads. They're literally tiny little particles that an interventional radiologist will deploy to essentially kill off a tumor. And traditionally, there is a lot of literature out there on what's called chemoembolization or TACE, which is kind of the first iteration of these intra-arterial therapies. But increasingly, we are seeing more usage of this radioembolization, where essentially the use of radioactive, what we call yttrium-90 labeled beads, to essentially try and target these tumors and lead to what we call tumor necrosis, so really trying to essentially eradicate the tumor there. Radioembolization goes by a couple of names, and so you may see it abbreviated transarterial radioembolization or TARE. Sometimes we use the term selective internal radiation therapy or radiation treatment, which is SIRT. Or sometimes we'll even use the term Y90, which is yttrium-90, and that's the radioactive molecule itself that's on these beads. And personally, I really do find this to be a very effective treatment for patients, right up there with options like TACE and external beam radiation. It can serve as a definitive treatment or as an effective bridge to liver transplantation. And at least where I practice in Boston, we see a lot of patients who are traveling quite a distance for care. And what's nice about this particular procedure is that it's given as an outpatient. And so patients only have to come to us a total of two times. One is for a mapping procedure to essentially map out that highway system to a patient's tumor. And then the second is the actual treatment procedure itself. And so generally, it's a very well-tolerated outpatient procedure, and I think definitely has a role in the local treatment of liver cancer. But as you can imagine, we do have patients every so often who do have more advanced disease that may either spread to some of the large blood vessels, including the hepatic artery or the portal vein, for example, even the hepatic vein. Or we do see patients who may develop metastatic disease, so cancer that is outside of the liver. And in those instances, we don't necessarily turn to these local approaches per se. We often will use what we call systemic treatment, which essentially uses medications that will go throughout the body. I would argue that systemic treatment is probably one of the most exciting places where we've seen a lot of new developments in recent years, such that I tell people, I tell many of my patients nowadays, that we don't even use chemotherapy for the treatment of liver cancer, and that comes as such a relief to many of our patients. Instead, the two main approaches that we see with the systemic therapies, one is using immunotherapy, which essentially tells the body's immune system to rev up to fight cancer. And then the other is using a type of targeted therapy that essentially cuts off blood supply to the cancer. And as you can imagine, there can be a lot of different considerations that we use as we're picking and choosing which of these treatments to use. But ultimately, whether in combination or using just one of these mechanisms of action, we've really seen some very, very effective treatment responses with these newer types of therapies. And so as we think about big picture where the field is going, you know, I think that some of the newest treatment approaches really do have to do with newer types of medications that are being studied all the time in the lab and in clinical trials to really try and improve outcomes for this very unique tumor type. I think that there's a lot of interest in how we can start combining what we know to be effective treatments. And so, for example, new research that's being done to combine systemic treatment with chemo or radioembolization, for example, or systemic treatment in combination with external beam radiation. So a lot of exciting movement there. And then certainly there's always increasingly the role for how to explore transplant-based options and how to sequence and mix and match all the different types of treatments so that we could potentially explore these curative options. And of course, as you can imagine, though, we can never really move the envelope in this field without clinical trials. These are really the mainstay of how we do research and how we really kind of push the envelope in cancer care. And so, you know, at any given institution, any given cancer center, there may be a whole host of different clinical trial options that may be open at a given point in time. And so for any patients or caregivers or families out there, I do encourage this to be part of your conversation with your care team, because clinical trials are hopefully opportunities where you may be able to have an opportunity to be treated with some of the newer technologies that we're exploring. And certainly as a clinical investigator myself, this is the way that we learn. We learn from all of you. We're always so incredibly grateful for our participants to really help us learn how to take the best care of patients. And so clinical trials can span the whole gamut. These can be therapeutic trials, so types of trials that are trying to explore new types of treatments, and those can vary across different phases where some of these drugs may be very well established in humans and others may be newer. So there may be different roles based on timing and your given clinical scenario. But I also encourage people to remember that clinical trials often involve other types of investigations. We do a lot of supportive care intervention research here at my institution, for example, where we might not be testing new therapeutics or new drugs, but we're really testing out new ways to deliver the best care. And we're always so appreciative of patients who are willing to take that leap of faith with us and help us learn. And then there are always non-interventional studies as well, where maybe it could just be a survey that you have to fill out or you're asked to fill out, or biobanking protocols where even your permission to collect an extra tube of blood or to bank your research tissue specimens always goes an incredibly long way. And so we're always so incredibly grateful, like I mentioned, for research participants. And if it is something of interest, it's definitely something I encourage you to discuss with your care team. And so at this point, I'd like to shift gears a little bit, though, to talk about practically what experience with liver cancer can look like for patients. Certainly, the first question that often crosses a lot of people's mind is, how am I going to feel with this? How do I feel because of this cancer? How will I feel on treatment? And what I've learned through the years is liver cancer is probably one of the most heterogeneous types of tumors out there. And what I mean by that is I can have patients who come to me who were essentially accidentally found to have liver cancer. Many of them may actually be on what we call a surveillance regimen or surveillance schedule because of some underlying liver disease. And so they're being monitored every few months for liver cancer. And then certainly I do meet patients who may be coming to the hospital because of significant symptoms who get diagnosed in that setting. And so it can really be wide-ranging as to what a liver cancer can look like at the time of diagnosis and how that can evolve over treatment. One key symptom that I'm always assessing in my patients and I encourage patients to be on the lookout for, of course, is pain and discomfort. And this typically is not necessarily seen for patients with smaller tumors per se, even patients with blood vessel involvement or even potentially metastases to other organs may not always feel their cancer. But what I do see is for patients who might have larger tumors, or if these tumors are hitting up against kind of the capsule, so the outside of the liver, that can sometimes lead to considerable pain because there are quite a few nerve endings kind of right on the outside of the liver. Alternatively, certainly if the cancer does spread to other places like the bone, that can become symptomatic. And so rather than suffering in silence, though, I always encourage my patients to bring these concerns up because there are many, many, many effective ways to manage pain and discomfort. Certainly cancer-directed therapy can go a really, really long way. There are approaches even, say, you know, not only with medications, but also, say, radiation that have been proven to actually help specifically with pain. But even beyond that, it's always an ongoing discussion with patients about what the best pain management approach may be, because this is yet another situation where that underlying liver disease, that second condition that we're always balancing along with the cancer, comes into play. Basic approaches like Tylenol or ibuprofen may not always be safe because of the liver disease. And so it is really important that you have a conversation with your doctors about, well, how much Tylenol can I take? Is there an alternative to ibuprofen or naproxen that I can consider? And sometimes this may mean other types of medications, or there are even other types of procedures that sometimes we can consider. And so it's all to say that there are a lot of really excellent strategies out there if patients are experiencing pain or discomfort, and we do think it's always a really important and helpful conversation with providers to think about how to approach that best. Now, the other main category of symptoms that I worry about sometimes, though, is what is happening. It's related to directly what's happening with the liver disease itself. Liver disease and cancer can really lead to quite a complex interplay, where if the cancer becomes advanced enough, it may actually lead the liver to decompensate or get sicker. And that can manifest as very unique symptoms that can be very uncomfortable. Things like fluid retention, which goes by the term ascites, that can be fluid retention in the belly. Patients can be at risk for developing bleeding in the bowels, or they may develop confusion like encephalopathy. They're never intended to scare anybody, but these are always things that I think it's really important to be on the lookout for, because there are effective treatments for these things at the end of the day. And this really highlights where it's important to stay in touch with your cancer care team. And often they may also lean on other specialists So gastroenterologists or hepatologists who are experts at taking care of the liver disease side of things, pain management specialists who may be able to offer procedural approaches for pain management or other types of complications. And then certainly the role for palliative care is really key and should never be overlooked, even early in a patient's course. And so I really do think that what makes liver cancer care so unique is really the importance of multidisciplinary care, not only with respect to the different doctors and providers who may be offering treatment, but also for those who can offer supportive care strategies along the way. And so, not sure how much time I have, but I'll take the last couple of minutes to really just kind of think practically about how to make the most of different appointments that you may have with your team. And I know that the topic of today was very technology oriented, which I think is great, but I also wanted to just take a step back to think about appointments in general. Often, appointments that you may have with your team are really your best opportunity to share what's going on, to provide updates, but also to make sure that you're getting all your questions answered and to have an in-depth discussion with your team about any questions you may have about the diagnosis, about the treatment plan, about what's to come ahead. And so I always encourage my patients to always write their questions down ahead of time if they can remember, bring their questions with them, and bring somebody along. That person can be sort of the person you delegate to take notes, to be jotting down. I've had folks even have, you know, a laptop open and they're jotting things down, typing away as we're talking, because it can be, you know, occasionally overwhelming during these visits, and we very fully recognize that. And we want to make sure that folks have all of the information at their fingertips that they can use to make the best decisions for themselves. Don't leave questions or concerns until the end of the appointment, though. That can make it really challenging to get an in-depth response to anything that's on your mind. And make sure that you have a good sense of what the follow-up plan is at the end. Even if it's we're going to regroup in another week, that is a plan. And so just having a good sense of what the immediate next steps are. Now, I recognize in recent years that technology obviously is playing a much larger role, and I'm a big proponent, especially in ensuring that we can deliver care, you know, to patients who may not even live close to a cancer center or what have you. And so that's really where the role of telehealth comes in. And my biggest suggestions for patients to really make the most of telehealth, though, are multifold. One is often telehealth visits in the cancer care world don't typically happen in isolation. You may be instructed to get labs ahead of time, to get updated scans ahead of time. And so if that's really the case, make sure that you've done sort of all of your tasks ahead of time to make the most of those visits, because if not, it could turn into just a phone call where we say, well, we need to get your scans, to get those done, and then we'll have a call again. You really do want to make sure you're maximizing your time. If you're able to, try and test out the platform ahead of time, test out Zoom, make sure your microphone and your camera are working. But we all know technical challenges come up, and so just feel empowered. If things are just not working in the moment, don't let that lead to a cancellation. Definitely feel empowered to turn your appointment into a phone visit if that will work for you. And then the last comment that I'll make in closing has to do with the patient portal, and this has to do with open notes, but also your results in general. I think the patient portal has been such an amazing resource that has come about for patients. And in recent years, due to actually legal restrictions, all results and notes get released both in your medical chart as well as in your portal all at the same time. So this is all going to happen in real time. And I hear from patients that it's actually not uncommon that you may get results back even at the same time or before your providers. And so in the cancer care world, a lot of times we will have dedicated appointments to review these results with patients. And unless there is a life-threatening emergency, it is difficult for you to be able to expect a phone call or an extra note to summarize that, especially if you have a visit coming up. And so I encourage patients to just keep that in mind as they're thinking about how to use the portal. Have a plan before your results return for what you want to do. I have patients who love to pore over their scan results. They look it all up. They put it into ChatGPT to translate into layperson's terms. They develop questions as a result of that, and that's amazing. But I also have other patients who actually purposefully avoid the portal because they know that it may just lead to anxiety in trying to decipher whatever is posted there before their upcoming appointment. And so rather than try and make that decision in the moment, I do encourage my patients to just think about how do they learn best, how do they process information best, and hopefully that will allow for just a smoother use of all the different tools and resources that we have at our fingertips. And so I want to thank you all again for the opportunity to join you today. I'm looking for the Q&A. We're looking forward to the Q&A at the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a superb presentation, Dr. Lawman. And you know, you were the first speaker, so it was a stellar presentation, and you really set the stage for today's program, just addressing so many topics. I know there'll be lots of questions for you for the Q&A, so thank you so very much. It was an exquisite presentation and really gave people so much information about liver cancer and its treatment and new technologies and follow-up appointments. You just covered it all. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is a oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And she'll be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. So nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in your tolerance to treatment, but your quality of life. Your diet might be modified throughout your cancer treatment just to assist with managing any side effects, and then, of course, individualizing it for your specific needs. Any other comorbidities you may be managing simultaneously, your plan can be adaptable to meet all of those needs. Some potential side effects that can happen are you know, a decreased appetite, potentially reflux or indigestion, the sense of feeling full quickly, even nausea, constipation, or diarrhea. Vomiting and weight loss are also possible. And a dietitian can provide you your individualized needs to include calorie, protein, and fluid goals. Also, any modifications that you may require due to chewing or swallowing challenges, for example. Typically, there are increased protein needs when it comes to the liver. And so a whole foods diet is going to be your best approach to getting your nutrition needs met. Occasionally, supplemental products might be brought into the picture, but that's on a one-on-one basis talking with your healthcare team. Now, each person responds differently to treatment, and so it's so important that you're communicating the changes that you're experiencing with your healthcare team sooner rather than later. In general, our goal when we talk about nutrition is to preserve weight, and the reason for that is when there's weight loss involved during cancer treatment, oftentimes it can really impact your lean muscle mass. And your body needs protein, your liver needs protein, and it's conserving energy. And so oftentimes it'll use that lean muscle mass as a primary source of energy because it takes less energy to break that down for your body to utilize. Some of the challenges of that is when you lose muscle mass, you can experience increased weakness, increased risk of falls, maybe even challenging with fatigue while updoing daily activities. So just to name a few, a couple of other things that can be impacted is a delay in wound healing, and even your treatment can be delayed if your weight loss is significant. Even if you're overweight, you can still become malnourished. This is an oftentimes a conversation I have with patients, oh, I have weight to lose, and that's really a misnomer when it's going through cancer treatment. We just need to be very mindful about weight changes during that time. There are medications to help with side effects. Make sure that you understand how to take those medications, when to take those medications. Have somebody there with you. Write it down so you know the best time to take them. I talk to a lot of patients, and sometimes just the confusion with the medications can really turn into some more of a challenge for the patient than it needs to be. So be mindful around that. Maintaining hydration is also very essential, and sometimes we forget about this when we're talking about the food. But a general rule of thumb is most people need between 64 and 80 ounces of fluid a day. So fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, and sports drinks, juices. Try to avoid caffeinated products if possible. So in closing, there are several members of your healthcare team dedicated to you. And so please reach out to us as soon as things start changing or if you have any questions. Thanks so much for letting me be part of today's presentation. I'm going to pass the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was just a superb presentation. just wonderful and very informative in terms of just working very closely with the dietitian, and also the issue about hydration, having adequate fluids, and that's also very important too. So thank you so much, and just an excellent, just a stellar presentation as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Danielle Staff. She's an oncology social worker, and she's our older adult program manager, clinical supervisor for cancer care. And she'll be discussing communicating with your healthcare team about your financial concerns, and review of cancer care free national programs and services, and a discussion of our Hope Line, give you the number for it, and also our website. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Seth.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Danielle, and I am the Older Adult Program Manager and a licensed clinical social worker at Cancer Care. We are a national nonprofit providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. People diagnosed with liver cancer may experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment journey. And these concerns could include things such as the cost of medical care, so hospital stays, surgeries, medications, outpatient treatments, and there's also the indirect costs, such as lost income due to time away from work, travel expenses to and from treatment centers, lodging during treatment, and childcare. So all of this can create additional financial strain, and this can become a significant source of ongoing stress. So it's important to know that you are not alone in facing these challenges, and help is available. It may be helpful to proactively discuss any financial concerns with your medical team. Oncologists, nurses, and other care providers can help connect you with internal support services, and many cancer treatment centers usually have dedicated staff, such as hospital social workers or nurse navigators, who are familiar with local and national resources that can help offset treatment-related costs, as well as information regarding insurance coverage, billing questions, payment plan options, and copay assistance programs. And if you are encountering financial hardships, there are organizations that might be able to help. So for example, Cancer Care offers limited financial assistance and resource navigation services. And resource navigation is offered nationally to patients and caregivers affected by cancer. It's a short-term, strengths-based approach where the resource navigator will work with you to help you find appropriate resources, referrals, and different sources of potential financial assistance tailored to your specific needs. Also, it's important to talk about the emotional and psychological support when coping with a cancer diagnosis, not only for those who are diagnosed, but also those in caregiving roles. So one may be relying on existing social networks. However, you may choose to seek further support through counseling or by joining a support group, and these options can provide a safe space to process emotions, also reduce feelings of isolation, and manage the psychological stress that often accompanies a cancer diagnosis. Sometimes hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer these services, and it just allows you a space to connect with others facing similar challenges, share experience, access valuable information, and offer mutual encouragement. Cancer Care does have online groups. So our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by professional oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. They're held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on our website, which is cancercare.org. There's a wide array of reading material as well related to liver cancer underneath the publications tab, where you can see certain topics such as communication with your medical team or coping with a diagnosis. And if you're interested in learning more about the support services we offer, such as resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops, community programs, publications, and limited financial assistance, I would really strongly encourage you to call our national Hope Line at 800-813-4673. And our oncology social workers, as well as Hope Line specialists, pick up the phone. They're trained in how liver cancer diagnosis impacts an individual as well as their loved ones, and will offer support. So thank you so much. It has been a pleasure to be a part of this very informative program today. And I will now turn the program back to Dr. Messner. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you so much, Seth. That was just a wonderful presentation. Stellar in every way, and also, addressing some of the financial concerns that people have, and also a review of all of the services and programs that Cancer Care provides. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
I'm going to ask, the first question is going to Dr. Malai. How do targeted treatment options work for liver cancer versus immunotherapy options?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And so I will say targeted therapy is often kind of used pretty generically in cancer care. And on the one hand, you know, I use the term targeted therapy to describe the very specific kind that has been tested and approved in liver cancer that takes advantage of the body's kind of blood supply and how cancers will kind of take advantage of new blood vessel formation to feed these cancers. Now, what you may come across elsewhere is also this idea of using molecularly targeted therapies, which use sort of molecular alterations or even gene mutations to then pick targeted therapies for liver cancer. That specific type of liver cancer or targeted therapy has not necessarily been shown to improve outcomes, in part because we just don't see as many of those molecular targets in patients with liver cancer. My hope is that will be an evolving space in the coming years to decades, but as of right now, we don't have that kind of traditional approach that you might see in other tumor types like lung cancer, for example. And so really when I'm talking about distinguishing between using targeted therapy and immunotherapies, I'm really thinking about a very specific set of medications. The specific ones that come to mind for targeted therapies are things like bevacizumab or Avastin, lenvatinib or Lenvima, or other similar types of medications. And really at the end of the day, I actually try and preferentially use a combination of these treatments unless a patient has other medical conditions that may preclude them from receiving one. So a common example may be a patient with very, very high blood pressure or a patient who might be at risk for bleeding because of liver disease-related complications. That might be a patient for whom I may not want to actually target blood vessel formation as readily in case of that predisposes to increased complications. Another example, though, might be a patient who has an autoimmune disease, or even for those who are post-liver transplant who need immunosuppressive medications, those might be medications, or those might be patients who I'm less inclined to use immunotherapy-based approaches in. So at the end of the day, it's all to say that I think we have a pretty expansive systemic therapy toolkit available to us, which we're very, very fortunate to have these days. And ultimately, it really comes down to the patient in front of us in terms of what their other medical conditions might look like, what their interests might be, how healthy they may be, what their liver function looks like. And we can really ultimately tailor a specific treatment plan based on all of those factors.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Another question for Dr. Are there any clinical trials for patients who have inoperable liver cancer?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And I would say a lot of therapeutic clinical trials actually start in that space. And so when we're talking about inoperable liver cancer, that often will actually include patients with advanced or even metastatic disease. And that often is the area where we see the most therapeutic clinical trial research. And so anytime I meet a patient, I try not to use a stage in saying, okay, you are or not eligible for cancer just based on stage or for treatment based on stage alone, because in reality, there are probably a lot more options if a patient is otherwise fit, if their liver function is otherwise good. And so I do always encourage individuals to really ask all the questions and really explore all the possibilities, because just because a liver cancer is not operable or it might be advanced or metastatic does not mean that there aren't good options, both standard of care and investigational.
Excellent. And another question for Dr. Is it common to do chemotherapy to shrink the tumor before a transplant?
Yeah, so I'll frame this in two ways. One is that we're not traditionally using chemotherapy, in part because it actually doesn't work as well as our immunotherapy and blood vessel targeted therapy approaches. Now, I would say the transplant piece is a tricky one. It is always a moving target. As many of you may know, there are very strict criteria that transplant teams will use to decide whether a patient is eligible for a transplant if you just look at the liver tumors themselves. And so at the time of a diagnosis, the patient may be told, oh, you may not be eligible for transplant. But I would encourage folks to understand that that's an eligibility determination at one point in time. And so it is possible that with any of our treatment approaches, local regional approaches may actually shrink a tumor down to make a patient transplant eligible. And I would say it is possible, or probably less frequent, that systemic therapy approaches may. Every so often, we do have patients who have tremendous, remarkable responses, especially to immunotherapy drugs, who end up developing what we call a complete response to these treatments and who do actually become eligible for liver transplantation. And so I do encourage, you know, not only my clinician colleagues, but also patients to remember that just because somebody says you're not eligible for transplant at one moment in time does not mean that that will hold true in the future, especially if a patient experiences a fantastic response to upfront therapy. Now, there are some caveats, though. As you can imagine, immunotherapy works in direct contradiction to what immunosuppression does. And so there are certain considerations that we have to think about in terms of timing a liver transplant relative to when we give something like an immunotherapy drug. But those are all considerations that can be taken into account with an appropriate team with expertise and experience here.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question for you. My father needs at-home. Oh, no, this will be for Ms. Saff. My father needs at-home care after his treatments. What can we do to handle the costs? It will be difficult to afford to hire someone, even if us three siblings chip in. Do you have any comments about that, Ms. Seth?
Absolutely. That is definitely a concern that we hear frequently, the cost of home care. And what I would really encourage you to do is to reach out to our Hope Line. Our oncology social workers and Hope Line specialists may be able to see if there's any financial assistance we can help with, as well as help guide you through and kind of talk through your situation more specifically to look at other forms of support and see whether programs and services exist not only nationally but in your area. We'll look into our database, see what resources we can find, that sort of thing. Also, talking to the treatment team to see, if there is any home care services available or if there's something that could be done through them as well. So definitely give us a call. And again, that number is 800-813-4673. But great question.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Lamain. I have AIH and am being treated with TACE for my HCC. Is TARE, T-A-R-E, a better option for me? If you could answer this in a general way and explain what all these terms mean.
Absolutely. So I think what we're talking about is the differentiation between chemoembolization and radioembolization, so TACE versus TARE. I want to start by saying both are still excellent options for the treatment of liver cancer. And so I often tell people that, I'm going to put out the disclaimer that I am a medical oncologist, so I often am the person overseeing care and giving the medication-based treatment. I'm not actually an interventional radiologist administering TACE or TARE, but in my conversations and in my collaborations with my IR colleagues, I think they're both excellent treatment options. And a lot of times, I would say that we're starting to see emerging data that might show that TARE may be more promising, but at the end of the day, you want it to be done at a center that has a lot of experience. And so not all centers may have that. It's not always cost-effective in many countries, for example. And so a lot of our really excellent liver cancer research may come out of other countries that just simply do not do TARE, and they still have really excellent outcomes. So I don't know that it's fair to compare the two right now. There's just differences in consideration. But certainly for any patients who are considering local options right now, it's always a worthwhile question for the interventional radiologist that you might be meeting us to, well, why TACE versus TARE or the other way around? And hopefully they can explain to you in your specific situation what might work best.
I want to thank our speakers. You've just been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants for asking such great questions. And we are going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway. And it means we'll start with Dr. Kelsey Lemain, and then we'll have Danielle Seth as well provide just a takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program. So, Dr. Kelsey Lemain, if you want to go first with a takeaway from today's program.
Yeah, happy to. I think the biggest takeaway is to understand that it's okay to look at liver cancer as a very complex entity. It's actually really complicated even for clinicians to understand and to balance between the cancer and the liver disease component. And so I think really crafting questions and leaning on your team to try and help answer those questions can be really helpful. So just understanding the complexity, embracing it, and really, you know, leveraging your team to the best that you can to really make sure you get your questions answered.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Seth, if you'd like to comment as well, your takeaway?
I would say that navigating a diagnosis and caregiving is very challenging and that there is support available. So please, please, please reach out, get connected to get some people who can support you during this time and the resources. It can feel like a full-time job, and there are people who are trained in knowing the resources and referrals needed that can just kind of help ease some of the burden. So please don't hesitate to reach out to Cancer Care.
Excellent. And I just want to thank all of our speakers, and I want to thank all of our participants. You know, we've done this program before, but I have to say this has been the best program ever. I think, you know, a year makes a difference, and we really, there's so many new treatments that Dr. Kelsey Lemain provided, and so many new avenues for psychosocial support as well. So this was really a wonderful program, I have to say. And we will be doing this program again. And I do want to, again, encourage all of you to participate in these programs. We have many programs coming up, so you'll be sure to get information about them. I do want to mention something. We've discovered that many of our participants have told us that they have no difficulty reaching their healthcare team during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays are challenging. And so please be sure to ask your healthcare team, you know, when they are available, on how to reach them actually, or how to reach them on weekends, evenings, and holidays, because that seems to be the more challenging time for most people. And it seems like things always come up, you know, end of the day, and weekends and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.